Live from the KTOO newsroom, I'm Rasha McChesney with this look at the news. Staff shortages due to the coronavirus and bad weather have combined to snarl air travel this week, and it's left a lot of Alaskans stranded. The double whammy affects all domestic airlines, but Alaska Airlines is among the hardest hit due to the heavy snow in Seattle, its hub. As Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports, on Wednesday alone, Alaska Airlines canceled 179 flights.
Unclaimed luggage was piling up at baggage claim in Anchorage. Some travelers tell of grumpy, impatient airport crowds in Seattle. Alaska Airlines reports that hold times on its phone lines are up to 20 hours. Chris Diamond, a union organizer from Anchorage, was stuck at the Fairbanks Airport studying the flight schedules. His first flight never arrived.
And I am now rebooked on, I don't remember which flight it is. It's supposed to leave Anchorage here in about 15 minutes, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
That flight was canceled, too. Diamond is less than 400 miles from home, where he hopes to spend his birthday and greet the new year. But renting a car wasn't an option.
Because the road conditions were so bad, they weren't renting anybody cars.
Meanwhile, his 19-year-old daughter is about to fly from Bozeman to Juneau.
So I'm trying to coordinate a contingency plan for her as well, because she has to go through Seattle. So it's been a hectic day.
Diamond urged her to delay her trip until the Seattle backlog clears, but his daughter is determined.
Well, I just wonder that she could be spending some time on the sleeping on the airport floor for a few days, so make sure to bring a pillow and a little blanket there with air travel bag.
Diamond got the last seat on a flight due to leave Fairbanks in the afternoon. This one's a 737. Diamond is pretty confident. Anchorage residents Jennifer Sauna and her husband called on relatives when their connecting flight in Atlanta was canceled on Monday. She knows how lucky they are.
You know, if my aunt didn't live here in Atlanta, it would have been hotels and possibly a rental car and all of those expenses incurred. Or, you know, we could have stayed in the airport and that would have been a pretty uncomfortable situation.
Well, first of all, I just want to start by saying how sorry we are.
Marilyn Romano is the regional vice president for Alaska Airlines based in Anchorage. She says she knows thousands of people are affected, some severely.
Particularly during holiday times when people have waited sometimes maybe up to 2 years now to be together and then to have their travel plans disrupted by something like this.
Romano has some suggestions. Delay all unnecessary travel until January 3 or later. Rebook online, not by phone. If your flight is canceled, go to baggage claim for your luggage before you leave the airport. Romano says airline staff are working to get everyone where they need to go.
I've heard great stories of kindness shown to our employees by our guests, and it is appreciated.
As for Chris Diamond in Fairbanks, well, the 737 was delayed, but he was still hopeful he'd make it home before his birthday. Reporting from Washington, but in solidarity with my fellow flying Alaskans, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A mining company is working with regional native corporation NANA to explore a big copper deposit in northwest Alaska. If built, the project could create hundreds of jobs and hundreds of millions of dollars in wages. But the mine and a new 200-mile road needed to support it would profoundly change one of the state's most remote regions, where residents still depend on subsistence harvests. For the next story in our series on the 50th anniversary of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, Alaska Public Media's Nat Herz traveled to the Upper Kobuk River, where he found residents deeply ambivalent.
It's a quiet late summer evening in northwest Alaska, and a young couple, Jeremy and Frances Williams, are upstream of their home village of Ambler, pulling into an eddy on the Upper Kobuk to haul up their subsistence net. Over the side, one at a time, flop a half dozen pink and chum salmon, the start of their yearly harvest. This evening, we're the only boat out on the river, which is rich with salmon and sheafish. Like many other residents along the Upper Kobuk, the Williamses depend on subsistence foods like these for a huge share of their diet.
Because we haven't even bought chicken for how long? I can't even remember.
3-4 years, maybe?
Yeah, our kids don't like chicken.
I mean, like chicken nuggets.
Oh, yeah, that one, but not chicken or beef. Oh, not beef.
It's peaceful and quiet out here as the boat drifts downstream. But there's a shadow hanging over this whole scene, an industrial-scale mining project and proposed 200-mile road that would cut through wilderness to near the villages just upstream.
If it happens, it happens.
I don't want it to, though.
Yeah.
It's going to change everything.
It's all changed the migration, pretty much. And I don't know. Just got to wait and see what they do.
I hope they don't.
You can find this kind of anxiety about the mine and road scattered all across the three different Upper Kobuk villages, particularly among young people. The next day, after a boat ride to Shungnak, the next village upriver, I run into some teenagers, among them Bryant's son, a 17-year-old who's into both basketball and subsistence, and who's not into the mine and the road.
Yeah, I mean, it'll make things easier for sure, but then with hunting and everything going on, and my dad has land just a few miles back there, traffic that'll be going through there with all that equipment and stuff going up there, it'll just scare everything off.
While Sun opposes the project, he says his dad sees things differently. And as it happens, we find his dad the next day. There's no road to the mining prospect from Shungnak, so Ambler Metals, the company developing the project, came to get us in a helicopter. The company's main camp is tucked back in the mountains above the Kobuk Valley. Helicopters head out from here to support crews drilling core samples from cliffside scaffolds. Groceries and fuel have to be flown in. After we land and take a walking tour, we head into the rec tent to meet with Fred's son, Bryant's father. Fred works here on a maintenance crew, using skills he acquired at another big mine in the region, Red Dog. Unlike his son, Fred supports this new project, but that doesn't mean he's any less connected to the land. He's an avid subsistence hunter, fisherman, and berry picker with two cabins on the Kobuk, one upriver and one downriver from his village. But as Fred says, people don't hunt by dog team anymore. They use modern tools like boats and guns that you need cash to pay for. And that's why Fred is not very sympathetic to his son Bryant's point of view that the mine and road shouldn't be built. Fred says Bryant hasn't had to work yet and that everything's come to him for free.
When you're Bryant's age, you know, you don't really have bills to worry about or house payments and things like that. He's never even bought a gun before, and he uses guns all the time. He doesn't realize everything he uses to help fill our freezer costs money.
This is the heart of the debate about the mine and road and about what's best for the three Upper Kobuk villages. This region is one of Alaska's most isolated. There's no road access, and fish and game are relatively plentiful. But what happens if the new road brings in competition from urban hunters? What if there's an accident at the mine that contaminates the river? But if those sound like existential challenges, Fred says these villages already face some of those. Gas costs $10 a gallon. High-paying jobs and housing are scarce. More than half the members of Shungnak's tribe are outside the region, Sun says.
I have so many friends and relatives that live in Fairbanks or Anchorage who would rather live in Shungnak, but there are just no opportunities there. There's no work there. The cost of living is too high.
The region's other big mine, Red Dog, has helped sustain Northwest Alaska villages with high-paying jobs and dividends through a unique partnership with NANA, the regional native corporation that owns the land the mine sits on. But Red Dog only has about a decade of ore left, and the only village downstream has objected to its impacts for decades. Unlike Red Dog, the main Ambler mining prospect is on state land, not native land. But NANA still has a stake in it through an agreement with the Ambler Metals Company. Ambler Metals President Ramsey Fawaz says the project won't be built without what he calls social license from residents, which the company is still working to get.
Nothing is can taken for granted. We would like to have social acceptance. We would like to maintain social acceptance. And we like to continue to work on it and improve it.
For now, there doesn't seem to be a consensus about the project in the Upper Kobuk villages. Some people are reserving judgment or think their opinion won't matter, in spite of what the company says. Critics and supporters don't seem to be able to bridge their differences, even within families or couples, like Lisa Lee and Alan Tickett in Shungnak. Ticket is an equipment operator at Red Dog.
I don't want it.
Good job.
It's gonna mess up the caribou migration. That's our way of.
No, but everybody in Amler needs jobs, though.
No, but that's what we live on. So caribou. It's gonna mess up our caribou migration.
Sounds like you guys have difference of opinion here.
Yep.
Well, because he's the operator, but I'm his girlfriend, so I live off the land.
No, she lives off my money.
The mine's construction, if it happens, is still years away. And environmental groups have also sued to challenge the federal government's environmental approvals for the road. The lawsuit has not yet been decided. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
Juneau could see its most significant snowfall so far this season between New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. A winter storm watch will be in effect for the entire Alaska Panhandle, with 6 to 16 inches expected in the capital city. Flakes will begin falling Friday morning and should taper off early Saturday as the system moves south. Kayla Tinker is with the National Weather Service in Juneau. She says the heaviest snow will hit the city overnight as people ring in 2022.
Be careful when moving heavy snow. The snow is probably going to be wetter than what we've been seeing. And be careful on the roads just because we do have the heavy rates overnight on New Year's Eve.
Near freezing temperatures are expected on both days. Juneau City officials are also reminding drivers not to park their cars on certain streets to avoid being towed during snow removal operations. Towing will begin at 8 p.m. each night, and snow blowing will start after vehicles are moved. There will be yellow no parking signs in those areas to warn drivers. Vehicles that do get towed will be taken to the Whittier Street parking lot near Centennial Hall. That is the latest from the KTOO newsroom. If you're looking for more local and statewide news, you can always visit us at ktoo.org. I'm Rasha McChesney.